What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. As always, I'm joined here by Varun.
Hello, everyone. As always, I'm joined here with Damien to begin today's episode of the Polititeen podcast. Once again, our podcast basically tries to spark conversation between teens and young adults about political issues and really to try to spark that political discussion to really advance our nation, because that's what we need as a nation. So before we begin, I wanted to first of all shout out our team. Our graphic design director, Jada Pilling, for the artwork that's displayed in our podcast, and Julia Harmon for the wonderful research that inspires our podcast segments each and every day. So a big thank you to them. And also make sure to follow us on Twitter at Polititeen Show before we begin today.
Yeah, for sure. So, I've been staying away from Twitter and a lot of social media, but I decided to hop back on because I didn't have too much to discuss. Yeah. For this episode today, and I hopped back on for like 5 minutes, and I think I've got the whole episode planned out. So, did you hear what's happening in front of Trump Avenue?
Yeah, I did, and I just read about that on Twitter because, like you, I was looking in preparation for today's episode on social media. But yeah, now that you bring it up, New York City, their city officials have been planning to put the slogan "Black Lives Matter" on the Fifth Avenue, which is absolutely insane because Trump Tower is there. So I think it is partly a statement towards support of Black Lives Matter, but also a statement towards this support of President Trump, because obviously Trump Tower is located. Thoughts about that?
Yeah. And he called it a symbol of hate. Did you see that?
Yeah, it was absolutely insane. His tweet was just jarred with not only hateful things on his part, but also infactual things. He mentioned protesters as saying, I'm going to search up what he said, look at his tweet right now, but he mentioned them as saying pigs in a blanket, fried like bacon, referring to police officers, right? But that hasn't been used since the year 2015, which was 5 years from today. So I don't know why he's blatantly lying to the American people and mentioning these kinds of things. And I feel like a lot of people are just believing what he's saying and getting brainwashed with these lies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I don't think that it's a majority of people, as we were talking on the last episode, that are really starting to get brainwashed. I'm happy that a lot of people are really changing and starting to listen to different points of views and just think that he's a gross person. But, an interesting point, something that I saw, was the fact that they have enough money to put this mural up, but they don't have enough money to defund the police. What are your thoughts on that?
Defunding the police, I don't think it requires money. It requires just putting funds elsewhere, which is completely, I think it's an easy thing to do in today's world. It's not a very hard thing to kind of reform your police and change certain aspects of it. It's more progressive than diminutive, if you know what I'm saying. But I wanted to mention how the New York Police Department actually had a $1 billion budget cut. I don't know if you've heard, because of New York City's new budget released by Mayor de Blasio this morning. But I think that defunding the police was not what happened this morning. $1 billion were cut, Damien, but we saw this money being cut simply because we had school resource officers being transferred into the education department. So it was not really defunding the police. I think it was changing the money into different hands to achieve the same exact purpose. So how do you feel about that kind of approach towards, quote unquote, defunding the police?
I mean, I think that defunding the police is something that just in general needs to happen. I think that it just needs to be a refunding and a remanagement of funds, to be completely honest. What would you say your ideal approach would be to defunding the police?
I think I kind of disagree with a lot of people and progressives on one point. I do side with a lot of kind of more centrist Democrats in saying that, and even centrist Republicans in saying that we need to reform the police before we refund it. And what I mean by that is I mean that we should kind of look into what the police are right now and what the how de-escalation programs are working in our nation and say what is working and what is not and set those two apart. And based upon that, reorganize the police and put more funding in the areas that work and kind of making the police more effective and place less funding in the areas that aren't effective or just abolish those kinds of areas. So I think it requires more introspection than it does require refunding. But I do think, I think in some circumstances, refunding also means putting more money into things like non-lethal force and more effective de-escalation training, as we've talked about on multiple episodes, because as always, I'm a very big proponent of the idea that police should have, first of all, the same amount of immunities as the American person, the average American gun holder. But also, I think they should also have a lot of ways to kind of have non-lethal force and not make guns a first option.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And, you know, we're talking about immunities when it comes to the American person. And I read an interesting tweet earlier. Obviously, there was the African-American boy who was killed for walking around with a toy gun. I think he was 13 years old. However, yesterday or 2 days ago, yesterday on the podcast, but 2 days ago, I believe that we saw a white woman and a white man aim guns at peaceful protesters, right? Of course, they were encroaching on private property, and that's a whole discussion to be had, but they were aiming weapons at peaceful protesters, and yet both of them still practice law and sit on the bar. I mean, it's something that's ridiculous. This is what I found odd about the situation. The husband goes on CNN. I think he went on Fox News too, but he goes on CNN, and he explains that he was just trying to protect his wife. Right, he was trying to protect his wife, and he's trying to protect everything that he's built over the past years. But you see later in the video, his wife gets closer to the protesters and starts standing on her side lawn, and again just proceeds to aim the weapon at the peaceful protesters, and, with her hand on her waist and you know, one hand on the gun, which isn't the correct way to hold the gun at all. She was holding it as a toy, literally holding it as a toy and as a means to intimidate people, as opposed to using it as a means to defend herself or her property. Because again, if they would have been so afraid for their own lives or for their property, then why were they getting closer to these protesters?
I think, honestly, that her and her husband saying things like that is not, you know, factual. I think it's simply trying to save their ass. And I'm very, very fervent in that belief, because, you know, you saw things like what you said, and I was looking online, looking at their overall release press releases and accounts from them, the husband and the wife, and what they were saying in a joint press release, kind of to acknowledge the situation, they were saying, we're in full support, solidarity for the BLM movement. Now, I have a question for them. Why would you say that you're in support of a movement when you're literally pointing guns at people who are supporting it? You know, It's a valid point that maybe they're on private property. They're walking through the streets, but were they ever poaching upon your feeling of, I guess mortal safety? I think it's one thing to have a gun in the house and maybe try to be safe in yourself, but it's also one thing to point a gun at somebody else, and that's not self-defense. Damien, I think that is aggression.
Yeah. I think that it really is genuine aggression towards the people. And he went on CNN last night and he said that people were approaching his property. And, you know, Chris Cuomo, who's a former prosecutor, you can have your thoughts on him. But he asked a genuine question. And he said, well, if they were approaching your property, where's the video of it? Obviously, this man lives in a house worth millions of dollars, at least. You know, it looked like a house that was worth at least a couple of million. And so Chris says, you know, obviously a house like that would have a security system. Guy says that he doesn't want to discuss his personal security on national television, but yet he goes out and aims guns at people, which again is supposed to be a means of security. He says that he was threatened, but again, if you were in support of a movement and I felt threatened, I would first of all just more than likely stay inside and see if someone was really getting close to your property, then actually go outside and respond to that. Or I would kind of protest with them, you know? Or I would go out and have a conversation with them as opposed to coming out and being aggressive.
I don't know if, I mean, maybe they, I think they perceived, and I'm just speaking the devil's advocate here, they may have perceived the people as, I guess, aggressive or maybe even rioters. But I think that the solution here is not coming outside with aggression. I think that if I saw somebody as a rioter and I was threatened in my own safety and in my own home, I wouldn't come out and hold a gun out, because what's that going to do?
Yeah.
That's going to cause the people to think of you as a more real threat. And I think that increases the chances of them coming out and really, really being aggressive towards you. I don't know what kind of rationale they were thinking of in their minds, but it simply doesn't seem right. Now, second of all, I do believe that both of them were lawyers, a white couple of lawyers.
Yeah, they were.
So, yeah, when they hop on television, they got to know that they can't come up with BS excuses. You know, Cuomo's going to cite them on that because, you know, he has a history of being in law enforcement, and they can't just make up BS excuses and then be like, it's almost like saying, I cite the Fifth. I don't want to talk about it because it's incriminating. And it really seems like that.
Yeah. No, it's just an odd situation. And again, we can kind of relate this back to what Trump's doing. When you're coming out and you're doing that, you're kind of inciting them to then see you as the opposition, see you as the person that they're going against. It's like saying, oh, I'm in support of the movement, but then shooting tear gas at peaceful protesters. It's just an odd situation. Obviously, we have to expect a higher standard from the president, but we saw what happens when people oppose this movement. They're seen as the white superiors. They're seen as this or that. And the president himself showed used them to use his political movement. And in a sense, I feel like whether they believe in the Black Lives Matter movement, which I genuinely believe that they do, whether they believe in it or not, they have been used in a way that I don't think that they were ever intended to be used in, or that their intention was never to be used in. The president is using them as political pawns. I'm just interested to see what the next step forward is going to be.
Speaking of political pawns, I was going to bring on a point about the president tweeting about Joe Scarborough murdering his staffer, but I'm going to wait until after our interview with Natalie Buxco because she's on in our guest room. So for an introduction to Natalie, she is running for the Georgia House of Representatives in District 24, and she's running as a Democrat. So she's a very, very big advocate for a lot of the issues that we're talking about here on the podcast. And we really, really feel like she's a great candidate for this area. And I'm really excited for this. How about you, Damian?
Yeah, for sure. And I think you gave a great introduction to her. But with that being said, we're going to cut to a quick message from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Natalie. Hello, everybody. We're back with Natalie. Our first question for most of our guests here, Natalie, if you want to give yourself a little introduction, actually, before we start with any questions.
Sure. My name is Natalie Buxco. The C isn't pronounced. I have lived in Georgia on and off since 2002, and I'm running for the Georgia State House of Representatives in the Georgia State Legislature for District 24, which is coming in Forsyth County.
Yeah, well, with that being said, I think that fits perfectly into our first question here. What really got you into politics? What made you want to take this leap forward?
Sure. So growing up, I actually went to high school in New Hampshire, which has the first primary. So my high school actually saw a lot of presidential candidates come through. So I was always interested in politics from a young age, because it's hard not to be when you have all of these big name people coming through all the time, you know, doing stump speeches and things like that. And mostly that was sort of just I was excited to start voting, and I kept apprised of things. And it evolved into me starting to knock on doors for candidates and volunteer for things. And lately, the political climate and the climate in America has just made it so that I could no longer sit by and watch these things that I thought were wrong happen. And I felt I really just needed to throw my hat in the ring and try to make some change and try to do something for the better.
Right. And that's an amazing introduction to yourself and your overall political start. You speak of a very distant and weird political climate today. Are there any specific issues that inspired you to make that leap and more directly inspired that leap?
Absolutely. So there's a few things. One of them is kind of it seems like a silly leap, but it's something that I think speaks to the way that it's the budget of the state is approached. I don't know, since you guys are younger, do you, I don't know if you remember from a few years ago, the debate about the what they called the brunch bill?
Vaguely.
Yeah, vaguely.
So in Georgia is a state that has blue laws, which in my opinion, shouldn't exist at all, because there should be separation of church and state, and it inflicts some one group's religious, you know, mentality onto everybody else. And it, you know, it didn't allow sales of alcohol at all from stores on Sundays, and in restaurants, it couldn't be sold until 12:30. We eventually overturned the no sales at all on Sunday in stores, and that came, but there was still the restriction of time, and the brunch bill was to make the times earlier. So to make it so you could start selling at 11 or 11:30 instead of 12:30, so people could actually have a drink with brunch on Sunday. And that would have brought in a, and it did eventually pass, but it, one of the big proponents in doing it was that how much more tax revenue it would bring in for counties and the state because of increased sales at restaurants during that time.
Right.
And I emailed the representative for my area, which is actually who I'm running against right now, and asked her if she would be voting for it. And she told me no. And that was the first time that I was like, you know, we really need somebody else. And from there, she and everybody else in Forsyth County voted against the hate crimes bill when it came up a few years ago, and when it came up just last week. They voted for HB 481, the incredibly restrictive bill regarding abortion that we hope to see overturned by the Supreme Court. So it's just, there's a lot of things, the way that they approach things, the way that so many of the representatives and senators from this area approach things, that just didn't feel in keeping with maintaining equality and human rights. And so I had to step up and try and make a change to that.
Yeah, and now that you brought up the brunch bill, it I remember where I had heard it. My family used to own a restaurant, and I remember that you know, on they couldn't sell the alcohol past or before 12:30. And you know, it kind of inspired me to ask you this question: do you have any direct plans for small businesses? Because beyond not being able to sell alcohol, obviously that does affect the revenue. But there's a lot of issues, and it becomes very difficult to manage a business. And from firsthand experience, seeing what my parents were going through and what my family was going through. It's very stressful, and it's not something that's easy. So do you have any direct propositions for that?
I don't have anything that's direct. Small business is something that I'd have to do a little bit more research into as far as any bills that go into that. But I will say, if you look at what's happening around the country and in our state with small businesses in relation to coronavirus, I do think that the country as a whole and the state need better protections for small businesses and for individuals in times like this. It, in my opinion, it isn't a, you know, it's not because we had to close, it's because the government failed to protect people. We could have been closed longer and really gotten rid of the virus if the government had been willing to step up and help protect people and keep their livelihood and make sure they could keep their homes and keep their families fed. So I do believe in more government assistance for small businesses. I don't believe in more government assistance for large businesses, because I don't feel that they need it. And I feel that it takes away from us assisting the folks who actually do, individuals who can't work and smaller businesses and things like that.
Right. You speak of, you know, a lot of these things like along lines of quality, small businesses, and most importantly, the economy. And I guess my next question is kind of personal towards me. I wanted to gauge your perspective on this. A lot of people across the nation have been talking about defunding the police, and, you know, changing state budgets and local budgets to kind of defund the police and put more money into other places. So I wanted to gauge, with today's racial tensions going on, what do you think the solution in terms of legislation is? Is it defunding the police? Is it putting more money into the police? Where do you stand on that?
For me personally, it's defunding the police and not getting rid of that. People think that defunding the police means getting rid of them completely. Yeah. And that's not where I stand. I do think there is a place for policing. I just think that it's gotten out of hand in our country. And I think that there are things that you should be putting funding into other things, especially when it comes, look how many instances where the police were dealing with someone with a mental illness where, or a disability, where they weren't trained to handle that situation, and it escalated to a point where somebody lost their life, and it didn't have to get there if instead the people who are dispatched to that are trained social workers who know what to do and can handle the situation better. And I think there's even police chiefs out there who say the same thing, that they've had to become everything to everyone, and that's not what it should be. There are police chiefs who agree with the stance that money could be put elsewhere for other situations to be helped, to be dealt with. And I think that is the correct way to go. I'm a big proponent of demilitarizing the police. I don't think any police force needs a tank or things like that. And I think that, you know, riot gear and things like that shouldn't be issued to every officer. I think that it should be only used in specific situations. And so I believe there is a place for policing. I have police in my family. I have NYPD officers who were on the ground on 9/11. So I get it. You know, I'm not coming at this from the outside. I completely get it, but I also think that there are ways to better serve society with that money. And I think it comes from creating a larger hybrid social services program that can be, different areas can be dispatched depending on the situation.
Yeah, for sure. And you were talking about, you know, police being kind of everything, and how police chiefs even think that police could be used more, I guess, effectively. Obviously, you had Houston's police chief, if I'm not mistaken, come out and say that his police officers were being dispatched to catch dogs, and they were being dispatched for things that he didn't believe that police officers should be dispatched for. So I have to personally, here on the podcast, we've taken the stance of agreeing on defunding the police, or kind of managing the police funds in an appropriate way. And that led to a discussion with Ted Terry, and he brought up a 10 for 10 plan, I believe that's what he called it. Where basically over 10 years, they were going to take, correct me if I'm wrong, Bruin, was it $10 million every year or $1 million every year?
I don't necessarily remember, but it was one of either of them.
So basically the idea being that slowly they were going to defund the police. Do you believe that that's the correct approach, or what do you think the proper approach to that situation would be?
Well, I mean, obviously in a perfect world, we would just, it's done. We're taking this money and we're giving it to other people, but it's just not realistic. I think any time that you talk about something like this, where you talk about reallocating funds, because I'm also a big proponent of Medicare for all. I'm a big fan of nationalized healthcare, especially I think coronavirus has made it clear how desperately we need people to be able to have access to affordable healthcare. But even as much as I want that, that isn't something we can't just take money away from our bloated defense fund and throw it into Medicare for all. It's something that has to happen in steps. So with defunding the police, it has to happen in steps. Now, would it take 10 years? I don't know. That's something that, you know, would need to be looked at, because you're also talking about, you know, when you're talking about defunding, you're also talking about people's jobs. You're talking about decreasing staff as well as decreasing, you know, spending on things like military surplus and things like that. So you have to be able to give people time to transition into a new position, or, you know, choose to do something else because of that. And you can't just do that on, you know, turning on a dime. You have to give time to do it as a process.
Right. And that's an amazing and powerful statement that we have about defunding the police. But I do want to ask you about one thing that's very near and dear to my heart, and it is, you know, abortion. We obviously saw Brian Kemp push forth anti-abortion bill earlier this month, and the Supreme Court has been kind of ruling against that, going on the other side of things with the Texas ruling and most recently the Louisiana anti-abortion bill ruling. So I guess I wanted to ask you, what is your perspective on abortion, and how, I guess, we can either support it or disapport it?
So my opinion on abortion is there to me, there isn't pro-choice and pro-life. It's pro-choice or anti-choice. And I am pro-choice. I am pro a person's right to bodily autonomy, a person's right to make a medical decision about their own body. Look at the mortality rates, the the maternal mortality rates in our country and in Georgia. Georgia's maternal mortality rates are unacceptably high. And you're asking, you're forcing people to go into a medical state where they could die with no choice for getting out of that if they don't want it. And so I'm incredibly pro-choice, but I'm also pro programs that reduce the need for abortion. So more funding to programs like Planned Parenthood, where people have better access. In my opinion, something like Medicare for All, where people have better access to hormonal birth control and things like that, you're going to see a reduction in abortions because people have better family planning options from the get-go. So I'm for better sex education starting in school so that people are more aware, you know, so kids who are having sex are more aware of the ways they can protect themselves. I'm pretty sure they've done studies that show there's a higher percentage of pregnancy in abstinence-only education than there is in robust sexual education because they don't know the options are there and they're still having sex. So right. I think that it needs to be, we need to have the option for people who have the capability of being pregnant, but we also need to invest in programs that reduce the need for it. And if you look at the statistics, as those programs have become more popular and available, the amount of abortion, the abortion rate has gone down. So I think that's the approach to it.
Yeah, and you bring up abstinence, and obviously I think Georgia is maybe one of the only states that still teaches abstinence as the primary form of birth control. But that kind of leads on to my next question here. Obviously, we're talking about in education. What do you think is the proper approach to reopening schools come this August or September, depending on where you live, obviously? But what do you think the correct approach is with the current pandemic at hand right now?
I honestly don't know. I know that I am myself concerned and uncomfortable with the idea of children, I mean, colleges, though they aren't sending adults back to school, but we're sending kids back to school. And, you know, in Georgia, for the most part, counties seem to have landed on just going to school full time, full classrooms, no masks required. And I think it, especially as we're seeing spikes in our state right now, I think it is a mistake. But I have empathy for the people, you know, for parents who don't have the ability to work from home and don't know what they're going to do with their children, who don't have the time to be assistant teachers for virtual learning. And I think that there isn't really one good solution to all of this. I think the good solution would have been to completely shut down and not reopen early, but we are past that now. So I think you just kind of have to deal with the cards that you've been dealt. And my preference would be for a hybrid model where students, you know, it's half the class in and half the class out, but that creates extra work for teachers. Teachers have to deal with both in-class students and virtual students simultaneously. And how do you do that? Because not only are we in this pandemic and having to deal with this, the GOP-led legislature decided to cut $1 billion from school funding for the state. So schools don't have the funds to hire temporary help to be able to do a hybrid model so that teachers' plates aren't too full and they aren't being overworked. So schools don't have the budget to come up with creative solutions because the GOP-led legislature took that away from them. So I'm struggling with the answer to that myself. We have to decide by July 10th if our youngest is supposed to be going into kindergarten. We have to decide by July 10th if she's going to go full-time or be virtual. My youngest stepdaughter is going. She's 10, so she's still in elementary school. And I know elementary schools have a little easier time of keeping classes together than middle school and high school. And my oldest stepdaughters are going into eighth grade, and they have a completely different set of scenarios than the elementary school. And so we have 9 days to decide, and I'm just not sure where we're going to land at this point.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think the education system is ridiculously underfunded, as you said. You know, I always remember, fondly remember cutting box tops in fourth grade to finance my school. So it was a really, really weird situation there. But I did want to talk to you about something that is on all of our minds as June ends and June was Pride Month. How do you feel about the LGBTQ community in our state and our community and how we can better support them? Because we talk a lot about racial tensions and equality on that line. And I think we should also discuss equality on this front, you know, queer rights and gay rights and things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm incredibly pleased that the Supreme Court just made the decision that you cannot be discriminated against based on your sexual orientation, your gender identity and sexual identity. So that is a huge plus, because I don't know if you guys remember, but a couple years ago in Georgia, they were trying to pass that what they called a religious freedom bill, which was really just carte blanche to discriminate against anybody you wanted to discriminate against.
Yeah.
So that ruling from SCOTUS prevents laws like that from coming to fruition, which is great. I do think that there needs to be some more protections, specifically regarding, I think it was Gwinnett, it might have been Hall County. There was a trans student who was elected homecoming queen, and the school was trying to prevent, the student body elected a trans girl homecoming queen, and the school district was trying to make it so it couldn't happen, and against the wishes of the students who voted for it. And so I think some more protections for trans students and queer students in education that makes it easier for them to go to school. And obviously we have anti-bullying things, but that only goes so far. I think there needs to be explicit protections for minority students of all kinds, for LGBTQ, for Black, Indigenous, and people of color. I think that there are a number of different protections that need to be explicitly stated, and not just, you know, no bullying based on whatever. So that way you don't have things like the what happened with that trans student and homecoming or prom. I also think that you could do things like, majority of bathrooms in schools are multi-stall bathrooms, but having just a couple that are single person bathrooms, that way you don't have to have a debate or a discussion or make someone uncomfortable or have a student who isn't fully out yet but isn't really comfortable with their assigned sex at birth. You have these single, you know, person bathrooms that students can use so that you don't have to worry about the issues that can come from having, you know, gendered bathrooms.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that really ties into to the next question that I'm about to ask here. You've been quoted as saying that in a nutshell, the economy, the environment, education, and equality are what you really want to focus on. And a big part of equality, the last point there, obviously with the LGBTQ community, and you were mentioning the restrooms, it also goes on to obviously other communities, and you can see a big discrepancy in communities in the criminal justice system. And you're a big advocate for criminal justice reform. Do you want to kind of talk on what you're really trying to push there?
Absolutely. I want to get rid of mandatory minimums. I want to get rid of cash bail. I want to get rid of private prisons. I think that our entire criminal justice system needs revamping from the ground up. That we already talked about policing. That's a part of it. The cash bail. There are people who have sat in jail for years because they couldn't pay $250 to be released on their own recognizance. And these are non-violent offenders. So, and they found in cities and counties and states that have implemented, you know, signature bonds, just released on your own recognizance with no money required, they don't see less people showing up for court. It works. And it's a strain off of the prison system because you don't have to pay for those people to be incarcerated simply because, I mean, you're basically talking about debtor's prisons at this point is what you're creating with cash bonds. Mandatory minimums, I think, are problematic for a number of reasons. I also think when you do something like legalize marijuana, like in states like Colorado, if you don't simultaneously release nonviolent offenders who are in jail because of marijuana smoking, you haven't done anything. You need to also do that. If you're going to legalize marijuana, you also need to release everybody, even though it was illegal at the time that they did it. Now you've decided it's legal, you need to release them from prison. So, and private prisons, I don't know if either of you have watched the documentary from Ava DuVernay on Netflix, The 13th.
I was going to, actually.
I have not.
Please do. It will make you so angry, but in the way that makes you want to do something. And one of the things that it talks about is how basically prisoners are used as slave labor.
Right.
In America. And private prisons are for-profit prisons. So it is in their best interest. It's one of the reasons I want to get rid of mandatory minimums. Private prisons' best interest that there are more people in jail. And that's a problem. When you create a for-profit business that requires people to be incarcerated, you're going to see more people being incarcerated. And that's just unacceptable to me. So those are just some of the things of criminal justice reform that I would like to see and that I would fight for.
Absolutely. I think that they're all amazing points. And I think it really opened up my mind about criminal justice reform. But upon the point of kind of reforming our community and our local area, I wanted to talk about reforming the environment. And we've seen a lot of questions about what is the future here with the environment. So how do you feel about our trajectory right now going into the future with the environment? And what are some forms of legislation, because I know you're a big environmental advocate, that you would kind of push forth to kind of help the environment and stop the bleeding?
Absolutely. I think that it's important that we take steps for all different kinds of protections. Something that I feel like people don't talk about, there's the big things, you know, there's carbon emission reduction, there's clean water. I think those are all important. And one of the things that points that I always make to people when they say, like, when they try to deny that climate change is a real thing, my response is always, so why don't you want to take care of the planet anyway? Do you want dirty water and dirty air? Like, right. even if it's not changing the climate, even if it's not creating, you know, global warming, it's still dirty air and dirty water. And that's the air that you're breathing and your kids are breathing and the water that you're drinking and your kids are drinking. So don't you want that to not be that way? Shouldn't you want to take care of the earth regardless of climate change? So so there's the big things like that. But on a smaller scale, if you look at driving down 20 coming in or out of coming to the west, there's all these clear cutting things where they're building. They've just cut down massive amounts of trees to build. And in my opinion, clear cutting is a huge issue when it comes to the environment. And I would like to see more regulations that don't allow, if you're going to build a neighborhood, you can clear space for, you know, where the foundations are going to go and in a lawn, but you can't just clear cut hundreds of acres to build houses and then replant a couple trees. You have to leave more trees, in my opinion. So there's things like that that are on a smaller scale that I feel don't get quite as much attention from the environmental discussion. And I think there's things you can do on a smaller scale that help your local ecosystem. So those are some of the things that I would look at from an environmental standpoint.
Yeah, and we've talked about, you know, on today's podcast, we've talked about the economy, we've talked about the environment, education, and equality. What is something that you think, it can even pertain to these situations, what's something that you think doesn't get enough attention? What do you think is something that's huge that you would really want to have a greater discussion about?
Absolutely. I think it ties to education and equality, something that I think doesn't get enough discussion. And that is, you know, one of the ways that racism and rape culture and sexism perpetuates in our society are the so-called microaggressions and the small subtle ways society tells you that something about you is wrong. And that's a huge problem to me that I feel doesn't get enough focus. So if you look at the Forsyth County Schools dress code, all right, codes are problematic from the word go for the most part in schools, because they're usually about criminalizing women's bodies for the sake of men's concentration, which is absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
But then if you look a little bit further, and from the dress code, it says any tattoo, hairstyle, hair color, clothing, inappropriately worn clothing, jewelry, or body decoration that interferes with or disrupts any legitimate function of the school, which if you can't pay attention because somebody's hair is green, that's a you problem, not a them problem. Apparel or appearance that tends to draw attention to an individual rather than to a learning situation, visible body piercing jewelry that is more than two items per ear and anywhere else on the body. So these are all things that are listed as against the rules for Forsyth County Schools, and there are no explicit cultural or religious exemptions to these rules. The principal is authorized to allow adjustments to this dress code on a case-by-case basis, but there's nothing that explicitly states and protects Black, Indigenous, people of color, and people of non-Christian religions from these dress codes. So if you look at how systemic bias often leads to situations here, and we've seen it in many other counties and states, is a Black student being told he can't have his hair in braids or locks if he wants to graduate. There's many non-Christian religions and non-white cultures that include nose or other non-ear piercings or multiple ear piercings as part of their belief system. And without explicit exemptions for religious and cultural reasons, this leaves these students open to discrimination. And it tells you that white is the default and you have to conform to white standards in order to do that. And that's a problem to me. No one should be discriminated against because of their hair or because of the body adornments that come with their religious beliefs. So that's something that I would fight for from a standpoint of education and equality. And I also think the dual language immersion program is another great example. It's because it's not only a way for English-speaking students to learn Spanish, it's a great way for Spanish-speaking students to learn English. And we have had an increase in Hispanic families in the district. And right now there are over 20 elementary schools in Forsyth County, but only four or five of them offer the dual language immersion program. And I know the district wants to offer more, but there isn't enough funding and there isn't enough support. Right. To get those programs into more schools. So that's something that I would fight for as well, because I think that not only does it help these Spanish-speaking families, you know, it also helps, you're going to create in young students at a young age, because it starts in kindergarten, you're going to create a cultural awareness to them that they might not otherwise have had. And I think that helps bring equality into their minds without really having the conversation with them about it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. You know, myself and Damien, as students, we've always stuck clear to the policy of nobody's born a racist. You know, I think it's ingrown within people, and education helps to contribute to that in some circumstances. But before we end today's podcast, we have a couple of minutes left in our show. I wanted to ask you, because we have a bunch of young viewers and young voters on our show, what would be your final message to our young voters and young viewers? And do Georgians across the nation listening to our podcast?
Oh, I think that what I would say is you don't have to be afraid of change, and you don't have to be afraid of stepping into the future. It can be uncomfortable to look at yourself and say, is something I am doing part of the problem today? I think it's vital that you do that, and it's vital you sit in that uncomfortableness for a moment so you can make the change and you can be better and you can help others be better. So don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid to tackle tough questions, and don't be afraid to use your voice. It's so important to use your voice. Don't think just because you live in an area that has always voted a certain way that your vote doesn't matter. Your vote absolutely matters, and the more people that use it, the more change you will be able to create.
Wow, I think that that's just an incredible message to end, this segment on. We want to thank you for coming on. It was honestly our pleasure, and you really enlightened us onto different subjects and topics that we haven't previously mentioned here on the podcast.
Well, I'm so thrilled to have been asked to be on, and it's so nice to see students who are taking an interest in politics and what's happening around them. It doesn't happen as often as you would like to see it. So it's a thrill for me to have been able to spend some time talking with you all. And as I said before, I really can't recommend that documentary by Ivy DuVernay enough. The 13th, please watch it. I think that you will learn some new things, and hopefully it will ignite a new fire in you for some justice and change.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your day.
Have a great evening. Thank you guys so much.
Right, so Damien, how'd you feel about that interview?
I think, man, I honestly, we talk about being enlightened a lot, and every episode, obviously, different points of view. That's what we focus on bringing here on the podcast. But a really interesting point of view, and something that I really loved, was when I asked her the question on something that she thinks needs to have more recognition. And I personally love the fact that she brought up, something that I hadn't been aware to, which is how much a school dress code can really impact the way that students develop and students grow and students change. It's incredible. And it attributes to racism. And it really got me thinking about, this idea where, oh, white privilege isn't a thing. But I mean, even in the dress code, it's crazy. You can't deny that that's not white privilege.
I was so kind of compelled to say systemic racism because it was a perfect example of systemic racism and even white privilege in some circumstances. I think the dress code is overlooked with so many issues that are happening today, and I feel like she was one of the most insightful people we've had on the podcast so far. And she brought in things that we've never thought about, talked about in the podcast, and it really expanded my worldview and my mindview because right now I'm more educated. And as we've been podcasting and interviewing people, I think we've been growing as people as well, Damien. I feel like you'd agree with me as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that the prison reform was something that was amazing. The fact that she brought up debtors' prisons, it's crazy to think, hey, it sounds ridiculous, but really, in certain circumstances, people have been in jail for years on a nonviolent offense for $250, and because people can't afford that stuff, and it really does become a literal debtor's prison. And for those that don't understand the term here, the debtor's prison was something that was used most famously by the United Kingdom. They would send, even to our state, they would send people who couldn't afford to pay off debts, and they would serve in prisons here until they could pay off those debts through their labor.
Right.
It's just such an interesting circumstance, and it's such an interesting point of view of looking at how jail bonds can really affect the whole. I mean, something so simple, something that you barely even look at, can affect the whole system.
You brought up debtors' prisons and the prison reform system that Natalie brought up, and I wanted to mention that one of the most jarring points in that interview we had today was talking about forced labor. I watched an interview by The Atlantic a couple of years ago, talking about how the Angola plantation, not Angola plantation, a plantation in Louisiana that was used to house slave labor, decades ago, is now being used as a place for forced labor where people who've been convicted are making less than basically pennies per hour. So it brings me to the question of how is that thing legal in the 21st century? Literally, we're having people on a formerly slave-owned slave plantation doing the same exact thing as slaves did so long ago. So I think that we're not done tackling the issues of racism, of unfair treatment and equality, and I think that we need to consider this above everything and on par with everything else.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, she mentions the documentary, which I'm definitely going to look into, but I think that it ties into majorly into the 13th Amendment, where the exclusion for the 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery is the last little phrase there. And it's crazy how a sentence, or maybe even less than a sentence, is so impactful even today. It says that slavery is prohibited unless as crime or as punishment for a crime. And I think that that just needs to be, abolished. I think that we need to get rid of that because, you know, you talk about people say, okay, so what? They're criminals. So what if we're not paying them to do their work? Well, you don't understand here, and this is something, you know, I'm happy that she created this conversation. In the prison system, you have to at times, and especially in private prisons, something that's becoming more and more popular is the fact that you have to pay to use cell phones. You have to pay for toilet paper. You have to pay for, mouthwash, for necessities, hand sanitizer, especially now during the pandemic. And if you're making a penny per day and they're charging you $2 to make a phone call, you're not going to call your family if you don't do labor every day for 200 days. And that's, you know, excluding the fact that you need soap, you need, to brush your teeth. Necessities, human necessities that I think that are being overlooked because of the fact that some of these people have committed crimes.
You know, we use the phrase in the 13th Amendment, you know, it forbids slavery and involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. Now, duly convicted is a very, very sparse and not a very good term to use in this circumstance. So I'm going to tell you why. The reason why is because a person can be convicted, but that person is not necessarily guilty. You know, there's so many innocent people in prisons across the nation, and we're having these innocent people literally suffer for basic necessities. And even it's not even like they're literally working for pennies an hour, as you said, and making these phone calls upon the system. And it makes me wonder, you know, why is the European prison system so much better? We're looking at prisons in Europe and Sweden, and they literally have everything that our prisons don't. So I think even prisoners, no matter what they've done, should get some sort of basic treatment. Because and we're looking at prisons right now, Damien.
Yeah.
Prisoners have been getting COVID-19 they haven't been getting treatment for the COVID-19 crisis. They haven't been having the right social distancing guidelines, and it's been one of the most overlooked places of spreading the virus than we've ever seen, like in the history of that virus. So why are we focusing upon prisons, and why are we focusing upon our health?
Yeah, I mean it's absolutely ridiculous to think about the fact that this is an issue. But this whole conversation again sparked a conversation that I was having the other day. I was talking about, you know, I always grew up hearing, especially in my family, and I grew up hearing, you know, listening to different sources for news that the criminal justice system was biased against African Americans and Hispanics. And I always heard, you know, no, judges aren't racist. You're served by a jury of your peers. How can you be unbiasedly, you know, acted out against? So I decided to do research on what that really meant. And it goes back to this issue, and it's so insane how this is so systemic. And unfortunately, the people that are suffering from this, you know, in Georgia, again, you saw 60% of mortalities being in African-American people, while yet they only represent, I believe, 15% of the population. And in prisons, that's going to be an even more astounding number because of the fact that they represent the majority of the population. And so I started to wonder why. And you really look into it, and it's because they can't get the same level of legal, I guess, service as someone with money, with connections could make. You know, oftentimes they have to pay for a cheaper attorney. And what does that entail for a lot of people that don't understand? Well, if you have a cheaper attorney, that's usually because he doesn't have the connections that an attorney charging you more money would. And if he doesn't have those connections, that means that he can't, you know, unfortunately, it sounds gross to say, he can't make his moves around the legal system, which is something that is a big part of the legal system, being able to make phone calls and say, hey, you know, my client needs this and that. Would you be able to take a year or two off his sentence because he's been doing this? You know, you have to pay for cheaper attorneys. So that's why their sentences for African Americans and for Hispanics are longer. And it's something that we need to look again. It's not racist in the sense that people are actively doing this to African Americans. It's racist in the sense that we did it and we're paying for it today. And we need to stop ignoring that fact, the fact that we're paying for it today. And we need to wonder, okay, how can we give a more equal, a more level playing field?
Yeah, you know, I think that people are saying, oh, in a lot of circumstances, equality means everybody gets the same treatment. But in some circumstances, it also means that some people get different treatment to meet that level playing field. And that's the goal that we have here right now. You know, whether it's college admissions or whether it's kind of any form of racial tensions, we need to level that playing field. And I can't forget the day that our legal services teacher was talking about how a 19-year-old sophomore at Baylor was charged with raping a student and basically making her, you know, forcing her to die face down in her own vomit. And the person, he literally had no jail time in that rape case, paid $400, wasn't even registered as a sex offender, and only had to attend counseling as a 23-year-old white male. Yeah. Now, it brings me to the question of if that guy, if he was a 23-year-old black male, the same thing have happened.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, again, it goes to the question of it being racism. And in this case, I think that if it would have been a 23-year-old black male who was the starting quarterback for Baylor, that I think that the same thing would have happened to the white male. And the reason that would have happened is because he has that privilege of being the athlete. So the issue isn't whether it's white privilege or black privilege. The issue is that, unfortunately, in America, it is typically the fact that black people don't have the privilege that the white people do. And I think that an important point to bring up here is the fact that we're not looking for equality. We're looking for equity. And what I mean by that is we're not looking to have the same push forward for everyone. We're looking to all be put on a level playing field, or to bring that level playing field closer together. And how do we do that? Well, we need to make sure that everyone has the same access to different things, regardless of their financial income and regardless of you know, different issues of their accessibility to legal services, of their family history. Right. We need to make sure that they're provided with the same level of treatment as a white person would, and that a black person would, and an Asian person, and an athlete, and a non-athlete. And we need to make sure that it's all fair for everyone. It's a difficult situation, but I'm happy that we're having conversations with people who are willing to have them. And I think that's something that we need to have in America. We need to have conversations, and that's it. We just need to have conversations and listen.
It shouldn't even be that, you know, race, or whether it's race or privilege or being an athlete, shouldn't play into the equation of what you did was morally wrong.
Yeah.
And these people are being able to walk into society with no eyes shed towards them and no ramifications for their actions. So it brings me to the point of, like, police are immune based upon their status as police officers. Are we immune based upon our status as privileged people or maybe athletes? There should be no immunity ever. I think if a person does something wrong, he should face the time and face the retributions for it. There should be no kind of form of immunity upon that. Now, I do see that our time has almost, you know, come to an end with you guys as viewers. So I would love to have a conversation on Wednesday about the same exact topic and leave with that topic, if you're down, Damien.
Yeah, but for sure.
That said, yeah, absolutely. And that said, make sure to follow us on Twitter once again at Politatine Show. And thank you for all of you who stayed up till the end of this podcast. It was one of our best, a very, very opinionated and you know, passionate podcast.
Yeah, definitely. And we have huge things coming our way, and huge things coming, especially for you guys as listeners who we do this podcast for. We hope to bring some exciting new episodes for you guys. But with that being said, as always, be sure to go out, have a conversation about uncomfortable things, because that's the only way that we're going to make a change in America. And, you know, thank you guys again for tuning in. Good night.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politatine Podcast. As always, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politatine Show, or to, you know, send us an email at politatinepodcast@gmail.com to connect with our initiative. And lastly, as always, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our research director at Julia Harmon for inspiring the wonderful content that we present day after day, and to our graphic design director and Jada Pilling for the graphics that illuminate our segments. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your days.